You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people.
Hello, hello, hello out there in YouTube and podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that lift and separate them above the average genre fare. Are you new to us? Well, David and I are old friends, and we've been talking movies for probably four or so decades now. And we're inviting you to join us as we tackle one movie a week. Usually a science fiction film if it's him, or a horror film if it's me. And we like to basically tackle the entire last century. So we do it decade by decade, sporadically, with no logic, just randomness. And today we are doing a science fiction film. If you have been listening to us, then you already know that. And you are back for more. I am here with my co-host and good friend, David Horton. David, how are you doing?
I am well. It's been interesting. Our last episode, I talked about 69 and how that's what I've been doing in my genre week. And finally watched that movie and didn't like it. And I also, this week, am on a negative roll again because I watched one that's been on my list forever. As a matter of fact, I also did it as a coming to get you a few months ago called Vesper. It just came out this past year. It says it's an English or British release, but it feels even more foreign than that, almost like a French film or Italian, more French than anything, Spanish maybe.
Is it like a live-action Fantastic Planet?
It's somewhat, yeah. It's post-apocalyptic. Basically, the rough synopsis is struggling to survive with her father after the collapse of Earth's ecosystem, 13-year-old Vesper must use her wits, strength, and biohacking ability to fight for the future. It's got some really interesting concepts in it. It deals a lot with this whole bio-organic technology. So computers are more like sentient plants, if that makes sense, sort of thing. Lots of bioengineering sort of feel to it. It's got some really cool photography in places, but the cinematography, in other words, the color palettes and the costume design and the design elements themselves, I didn't like very much. And this movie is probably the slowest movie I have watched in a long time. It was a slog to get through it.
I am confusing it with the series that you were watching. I didn't realize it was a movie.
Vesper?
The series that you...
The series that I was watching? What was it?
Yeah, the one that had Chloe Grace Moretz and Jack
Oh,
Rainer.
That's called Peripheral.
Okay, I was confusing it with Peripheral. Sorry. So Vesper's a movie.
Yes, Peripheral ended up... you know, almost having promise, but not sort of thing, as I think I said in that whatever that episode was. But yeah, Vesper is a movie, came out this past year.
Okay.
Literally no one involved in. I did research on it. Has three different writers, two different directors. Nobody I recognize it. The girl in it.
Is it foreign?
It says it's a British release, but and it's not dubbed. And you recognize one person in it, which is the evil bad guy at the beginning, but he's gone from the story fairly quickly.
Well, its countries of origin are France, Lithuania, and Belgium.
Yeah. So
that's why you're getting that foreign film feel.
Yeah, that influence, yeah. I guess. Rafaela Chapman is the lead. She actually plays Vesper. She's really good in it. She doesn't look 13 to me in the film, but she's supposed to be. But she's really strong throughout the movie, but it just, it's so slow and so dragged.
Oh, yeah. I'm not watching it. There's no way.
Why? Just because I said it's slow?
Well, you said that it looks like a French film, very like Fantastic Planet. Yes. You said it's slow, and I'm like, I'm out. I like slow burn horror, but I don't like slow science fiction that looks like it's a foreign film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and if you watch the trailer, you'll see a lot of that influence, the whole bioorganic plants talking to you, coming to life sort of thing. The catchphrase of it is, one seed can change everything.
I know, I remember. So. And there's like a little robot that floats around her, that follows her.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that
I seem to remember all
and
this.
And that is essentially the they call it a drone, even though it looks, they've painted it with a smiley face. So you get the impression all the way through it, it's kind of like Wilson in The Castaway. But
yeah, no. And it stars a kid. I'm out.
Yeah, it probably would not be on your list. No. And I wouldn't put it on anybody else's list. I mean, if you're a hardcore sci-fi geek, maybe you want to watch it on a bad afternoon. But no, I wouldn't recommend this movie. So that's what I've been doing. What did you do this genre week?
I think I did something a little more exciting.
I'm sure.
Oh my gosh. In my genre week this week, I watched a little movie that's streaming on Netflix right now called The Rental.
Ooh, okay.
This movie has a lot of connection in it. It's a small movie, which you know I love. Mm-hmm. It's only got like really 5 cast members.
Yeah.
And it is directed by Dave Franco, who is not only James Franco's brother, but he is also Alison Brie's husband.
Wow.
And Alison Brie is the star of this.
Oh, okay. I love Alison.
He has normally been an actor, but I think this is his directorial debut. If not, it's one of his first films. He directed his wife and Dan Stevens, who I love. I think he's great. I first saw in Downton Abbey and has been in a million things ever since. So it stars him and Alison Brie. And if it couldn't get any better, it stars Sheila Vond, who is the girl who walks a home alone at night.
Oh, no. Yeah, okay.
Yes. There you go. The girl from the independent vampire movie that I like, the Iranian vampire Western movie, is in this movie. This movie, well, it's not really a horror movie, but there are motifs in it that are very similar to that movie I discussed a while back called Super Dark Times.
Okay.
Where things just start getting bad and then just spiral into worse and worse and worse. Basically, two couples on an oceanside getaway grow suspicious that their host of this bed and breakfast seemingly is spying on them. Before long, and this is a beach rental, by the way, before long, what should have been a celebratory weekend trip turns into something far more sinister. As well-kept secrets are exposed, and the four old friends come to see each other in a whole new light. I called a friend of mine the other day that I hadn't talked to in a while, and he said, "Watch The Rental." And I was like, "Okay." So I did, and he was right. I was like, "Oh, wow, this is pretty good. It's got some twists." Okay. And really, the only characters, other than a dog... And I know what you're thinking. Yep. That dog's going to die.
That poor dog.
Well, I'm not going to give anything away. But it just stars four people plus the caretaker of this place where they're staying. And that's it. Two couples, two brothers, and their dates. Well, one's married and one's not.
Right.
So, highly recommend it. Check it out.
Interesting.
That's what I did this week.
Wow. Okay. But so is it like The Invitation or, you know, those kind of where it's the now you're suddenly in a life and death struggle game? Or is it more of a, you know?
It's definitely a life and death struggle game.
So it's Happy Birthday to Me.
And actually, now that I think about it, there's really 6 characters in the movie. But It's life and death, but as far as being like The Invitation, it's not one of those where you realize, oh yeah, this is going on everywhere. This is all concentrated on that location.
Okay. All right.
So
it's a microcosm hostel.
Yeah, kind of. I've never seen a movie like this before. I mean, it's a mishmash of different tropes. And one of them strongly is that one I was talking about from Super Dark Times, where all of a sudden somebody's dead and things start spiraling out of control.
Right. Okay.
It's like, you know, we need to cover this up, that kind of thing. And then, but wait a minute, this could happen to us, that kind of thing. So I don't want to give too much away, and I probably already have, so I will shut up.
Okay.
But I would watch it. It's fun. It's short, you know, it's like an hour and a half, and it's just an in-out. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, so there's no segue out of that into what we're talking about today. We just can't.
Kind of, in a way, because it is about a married couple.
A married couple moving to or staying in a new place that gets awfully uncomfortable. How about that? We'll try that one. For those of you just joining us, or you know, who have been waiting patiently while we tell you what we've been doing, we are in sci-fi world this week. We're going all the way back to 1975, not 2004, 1975, the original, The Stepford Wives. This movie was directed by Brian Forbes. It was written by William Goldman, based on Ira Levin's novel. Ira Levin, who actually is much more popular, I think, theatrically, or better theatrically, than he is with novels. And William Goldman doing the screenplay for it stars Catherine Ross, Paula Prentice, Peter Masterson. I remember this movie as being a big thing when it came out. It was pretty huge at the time. And I think there's going to be dozens of keys that we're going to get out of it. If you haven't seen it, we're going to spoil it. So please go watch it now and then come back. But in a nutshell, you've got a younger couple. She's younger, I think, than him, or at least looks that way in the casting. Joanna, the Eberharts. And they move out of the bustle and the, you know, the terribleness of urban New York City up into the quaint countryside of Connecticut to a town called Stepford that her husband has found and with their family, but soon discover that there are sinister things that are happening, especially to the female residents of the town. That's cryptic enough to say it, I think, as a synopsis. I'm sure you had seen this movie before, correct?
I have, but it's been so long ago that I don't remember it. I think I probably saw it when it was like the movie of the week on television.
Okay. I didn't see it at the theater either, no, but I did see it on television a few times, and I did watch it on video at least once, sort of thing. This falls into that category of, I remember this movie being a lot better than it is, I think.
I'm almost the exact opposite. I went into this movie with very low expectations and was actually a little surprised that I enjoyed it a bit.
Okay. So, okay, good.
Yeah.
Then that'll give us stuff to talk about, so to speak.
Yeah.
I have in my notes, we should start this episode with, we'll just die if we don't get your likes. We'll just die if you don't subscribe. We'll just die if you don't subscribe. Because that's that big scene with what's her name in it, the other.
I'm just making coffee. I'm just making coffee.
Yeah, Charmaine.
Yeah. A little background on my part is you specifically, for those of you out there that don't know this, here's a little tidbit. David was looking for some criteria when selecting movies this season, mm-hmm. and he mainly based all of his choices on movies that were adapted from books.
Yep.
So I've taken it upon myself to read a lot of what we're doing this year. Mm. And I tried to read this book and I couldn't read it. It was terrible.
But this is the same guy that wrote Rosemary, right?
It is Ira Levin, who I have never read before. However, I love the movie Rosemary's Baby. And I was like, it's like the book didn't know what it wanted to be. It was like, is this a comedy? Is this a satire? Is this horror? Is this science fiction? I don't get it. And it was rapid-fire dialogue with very little exposition. There were so many characters, I couldn't keep them straight. And after I got about a third of the way into it, I just put it down. I was just like, I don't want to, I'm just going to watch the movie. Fuck this. So now, having read some background on this movie and seen a little bit as far as supplemental material on video, this is a plague production. I mean,
yeah,
people did not like the fact that this British guy, Brian Forbes, was directing it. William Goldman sounded like he was a total dick during the whole production of it, of getting it made. And I think that Brian De Palma being a choice and not getting the gig because of William Goldman was a huge mistake. I think Brian De Palma could have made this a really good movie. Do you think that?
Yeah, I think so. Well, first of all, I think we've got to kind of weigh this, the production of it, and that's a good place to start, of course, with how it happened. This movie, when you watch it now, looks like a television movie. It looks like it was shot for television. It's very basic cinematography. It's very basic lighting, music, and color palette. The music is extremely television.
Commercial music.
Which, if you think about it from the author's point of view, again, I didn't read the book, so I can't go from that. But I know that William Goldman wanted this to be almost like a female manifesto. I mean, he talked to Gloria Steinem. He talked to other people in the feminine, the women's live movement and everything else, and wanted this to be an indictment of male patriarchy in society. And wanted it to be a liberating feeling for women. Instead, it comes off as very petulant, very... It doesn't hit any of those high notes. And from what I understand, a lot of that has to deal with the changes that Brian Forbes made to Goldman's screenplay. It's one of those where I'd really love to get my hands on the original screenplay and read it.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, is it not out there?
I don't think so. I haven't been able to... I honestly didn't totally research it to find out, but I didn't...
No, I didn't either.
But this is plagued because a lot of people classify this as a comedy. And actually, the remake they made in 2004 is a comedy. And I didn't...
Very similar to the book.
I never got this as a comedy. I got it as a mishmash. Like you said, they didn't know what they were trying to say or what they were trying to tell.
And the only real feminism you get from it is her and her friend, you know, bonding... And saying let's liberate Stepford, and they basically, you know, don't get very far at all.
Yeah, yeah. And if you watch documentaries on the making of this, the cast actually loved the set environment. It was very nice and very relaxed and very easy. And he was very open to suggestions from the cast and changes from the cast and all that. To which Goldman, of course, was upset a lot, but.
And I have to say, William Goldman has a great track record.
Oh my gosh.
One of the best screenwriters. If he was being a dick, maybe he had reason.
I mean, this is the guy that wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Papillon, Waldo Pepper, All the President's Men. I mean,
Magic.
I was just about to say Magic. Yeah. Misery. Princess Bride, for God's sake. He's great at adapting. Yeah,
I mean, he has got a marvelous track record. So that's why I was kind of shocked by how this film turned out.
And he's great at adapting screenplay. I mean, adapting novels, you know. So the trouble in appreciating this movie has to come in to, you know, has to fall on Brian Forbes. If not him, then at least the, you know, him and the producers. Because it's just not the same as what... But then again, to your point, maybe the material, the Ira Levin material... Goldman had struggles with as well.
Like I said, I couldn't get a clear picture of what he was trying to do. And I can't get a real clear picture of what this movie's trying to do either. So.
Yeah, one of my first notes is, what is this movie about? Is it a scary? Is it a satire? What is it? I don't understand. It's a very shallow rip or pastiche of feminism, if it is. Yeah, there's definitely gender politics in it. There's consumerism in it, and the fact that there's rampant product placement in this movie. I mean, everywhere.
And it's the real product.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't change the name.
No, it's Brillo and Taster's Choice and all the stuff from the 70s.
Sanka,
yeah. But it could have done so much more. That's why I was kind of interested in watching the remake and thought, wow, are they going to really take it, modernize it, update it, make it work and everything else, really make it an attack on, you know, mm-hmm. male patriarchy and all this kind of stuff. But I watched the trailer and went, nope, I'm not watching that movie. I mean, it's directed by Frank Oz. I went, that's not probably going to be a drama or a horror movie. So, not going to.
Well, and Matthew Broderick as the lead doesn't scream horror either.
No. Well, yes, no. But like we said, in production on set, they said they had a great time. However, prior to that and during the set, at least at the beginning, Goldman and Forbes fought almost daily, all the time, and to the point that Goldman actually walked away from the project and refused to even speak to Brian Forbes again. So it was not a good relationship for the writer and the director, so to speak.
No. I just wish I could have seen the film Brian De Palma would have made.
Let me ask, because De Palma, well, how do you think De Palma would have changed it? What would he have done, do you think? What would have been the big deals?
I just think it would have been scarier and more suspenseful.
I agree with that.
Because he knows how to generate suspense. And he was looking for a big break because the success of Sisters was not as big as he had hoped. And he had just done Sisters, a movie we've covered on this podcast. Mm-hmm. And when he didn't get this, he went on to do a movie called Obsession, which I've never seen. But then his very next movie was Carrie, and he just hit the big time. So he was ready. He was on the threshold of being big, and this could have been his big movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it took another year or two and two movies.
So. And I think he would have hinted, he would have created that dread, because he's very influenced by Hitchcock. I think he would have created a lot more dread and ominous sort of feel all the way through it. Which Forbes tries to hint at a couple of times, but is done in such a terrible way, I think.
All right, let's talk about the big problem. One of the biggest problems in this is the fact that he has all the, quote, Stepford wives dressed like they're in Little House on the Prairie.
Yes.
They wear long gowns and high collars, and they look different. They shouldn't look different. The scares should come from when you start to realize they're different. But you realize they're different upon sight.
Yes. And the way they're played, which is his
right.
His wife is the first one we meet, Van Zandt. Mm-hmm. And she plays her so, quote, robotically,
picture.
That you know something's odd and something's off.
But then you meet her friend, I can't remember her name, and then the Tina Louise character, who are not Stepford wives yet. And
correct.
They are not dressed that way, and they act like normal people.
Bobby and Charmaine.
I think it would have been... Right. And I think it would have been scarier not being able to tell who was a Stepford wife and who wasn't.
I think it would have been scarier, and I think this is an assumption, but I think this was in Goldman's script, because Goldman... Well, you know, that the dress comes down to the fact that in Goldman's script, they're much more, in his literal quote from the script, more like Playboy bunnies. So
right.
Once they get assimilated into Stepford, their breasts are endowed, they're much more leggy, they're wearing mini skirts, they're much more sexual. And that would have been interesting to see, like, the Charmaine Tina Louise tennis player get even more sexy, which she was dialogue-wise. She was going, I am going to please my husband and blah, blah, blah. You know, that sort of thing.
Right.
But not in dress. Like you said, she's dressed pseudo-Victorian or pseudo-Little House on the Prairie. And even somebody in defending it in one of those documentaries, I think it might have even been Catherine Ross, but she was saying they dress very much like 50s icons and everything else. No, they don't. That is not a 50s dress. They're not T-length. They're not the apron in front sort of feel to it with the off the shoulders. They're in these up to their neck, down to their wrists, long skirts sort of thing. And supposedly, based on production notes, that came about because of,
of him casting his wife, which was probably another mistake.
Yeah, Nanette Newman. And also, according to the producer, Sherrick, that was part of the deal. If he was going to direct this movie, his wife was going to be in it.
And you know who she replaced?
No.
I was going to do this in casting, but she replaced
Joanna Cassidy.
Joanna Cassidy. Yeah.
I thought Joanna Cassidy. Joanna wasn't the lead? Joanna Cassidy
maybe she
was the lead and got replaced.
You may be right. I'll look better when I get the cast. No, Joanna was going to play Bobby Marco. Excuse me.
Okay, Bobby. But okay.
I am so sorry. I had that wrong. But Joanna Cassidy was supposed to be in this movie and for some reason got fired. And I was like, that's strange because I love her. I think she's great.
Joanna Cassidy? Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Anyway, we'll get on to that later.
I mean, I'm going to go on a limb and blame Forbes totally for this, because even Sherrick, looking at him as the producer, this guy did Sleuth. He did The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, The Heartbreak Kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy was a good producer, too. So you have a great screenwriter, a good producer, and a fairly competent cast, and your movie isn't scary and seems convoluted and doesn't make a lot of sense.
Then, it looks like a 70s commercial, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then I think you got to go with the director. You got to go with Forbes and his inability to achieve the mood that he wanted. Kind of segueing to scenes and stuff, I do like the final mansion scene. I wish it was the whole movie had that feel to it.
The scare, because it's dark and scary.
Yeah, it's dark. The lighting is great. There are times when they're almost in total silhouette shadow. The dialogue is very foreboding. I mean, she looks at him very plaintively and says, why? And he looks back at her and goes, why? Because we can. And walks over here and you're just going, oh my God, there's no really even a reason for this other than we have the power to do it because we're the men. That's scary, you know, and it was...
It was very scary.
And I love the fact that he went almost full frontal nudity with her. And the black eyes and all that was good stuff.
I mean, that's not really her body, is it? Because she, in earlier scenes, was wearing, like, where she tied a shirt. And she's a lot flatter up here than she was in that last scene where she's the robot.
I think one of the things I thought was that, yeah, that was her. They actually flattened her more in the other scenes. So that they would give her, you know, and she's through a negligee anyway.
Well, I was saying, I think they put a fake nude body to be seen through that negligee that was a little more Playboy-esque.
Maybe.
Then that's what it looked like to me.
If they hadn't, anyway. They should have for most of the, I mean, that should have been the thing with all of them, with Carol,
right,
with Bobby, with everyone, should have had that kind of sensuality to it sort of thing.
Totally agree.
Well, do you want to do scenes before we jump into cast?
Sure. I mean, we can talk scenes. There's a few interesting scenes, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
The one that comes into mind immediately is the one where she says, I bleed, and she cuts her hand, and she's like, do you bleed? And she stabs her. I was like, first of all, that's not realistic at all. I don't think she would stab somebody.
Agreed.
Even if she suspected they were a robot, I don't think she would have stabbed them. However, it is jarring to see her do it and no blood come out.
Yep.
You know, to prove her point. So I see why they did it, but I think it was a failed attempt.
I agree. I was trying to think of another way of doing it. An excuse or a something or whatever. Because the whole purpose of...
She could have accidentally cut her finger while chopping vegetables and them talking. And actually didn't cut it off and it not be bleeding. And that would have been great because you'd have been like, what the fuck?
Yeah. But I don't know if that would have been enough to throw her into a tizzy, you know. Like, we get a hint earlier because Carol has the accident in the parking lot, which isn't really an accident. It was a little bit fender bender, and suddenly we're calling the ambulance and freaking out, and she's got a head trauma.
And the damn grocery boy is directing traffic in the parking lot. I've never seen that happen.
Yeah, no, no. So I thought that was...
But yeah, and then bizarre. She has the alcohol, well, the supposed alcohol incident at the party where she's repeating what... Something about a recipe.
That's the one I was doing. I'll just die if I don't get that recipe. I'll just die if I don't get that recipe.
So that's the hint, like you said, that they are there's something up.
And looking at it this time, I remembered thinking this when I rented it on video back in like the 80s and watched it and went, you know, these freaking things are pretty delicate. He needs to work on this. If little be things like one stab wound or one little fender bender can make them all freak out, they don't need to be on the market yet. They're dangerous.
No. Yeah, this is a prototype.
Yeah.
Then, of course, the other scene is when she, like you said, is running from him after he says, because I can, and what's really striking about it to me at first is that she goes into a room that looks exactly like her bedroom.
Yes.
And you're like, how did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And then she sees her robot sitting at the table, and that robot turns and has the totally black eyes. So I'm assuming she's not finished yet because mm-hmm. they haven't put the eyes in or what have you. That's another big, I would say, one of the more memorable scenes of this movie.
Yeah, and the only one I would probably, other one I would add is the coda, the very end scene where we're in the grocery store and we finally reveal Joanna, although I think it goes on way too long. It's like a good 4-minute scene at the end of the movie.
It's like a curtain call.
And it needs to be much faster and much different, I think, in feel of this oppression of we're all turning into this kind of thing. But again, I don't think they knew what they were, the message they were trying to say kind of thing. I think Paula Prentice is the best actress in the movie. I think she's great in this whole movie.
Yeah, and that's the role that I said Joanna Cassidy was going to get.
Yes. Yeah.
Bobby Marco, the one that's her cohort in trying to liberate the women of Stepford.
Yeah. I mean, her entrance is she approaches Joanne in the field going, oh, my God, are you who I think you are? Hello. You know, and just the change in her is so drastic. And that's what would have worked even better had we had more of a horror director taking care of this movie.
And how about that scene, her not being dressed in that weird Victorian or whatever dress? How about she not realize it's happened until like in deeper into that scene?
Oh, yeah.
That's suspenseful, and they don't have that at all. And you know it the minute she walks in the door.
Agreed. And it should be little stuff. It should be stuff like she comes in and she's, oh, sit down. Well, I'll get you some coffee. Just sit there, tell me all about it. Sit down. And as she's waiting for the coffee, she's looking around and seeing how neat the room is for the first
time. And then, or seeing her clean something.
And then like see her clean
like wiping something out of character.
And then weird. And then noticing that she's, you know, her breasts have increased like 2 sizes. Kind of thing.
And instead of that, we get her in that weird dress immediately, and we already know what's happened.
Oh, yeah.
It sucks. It's really, and you're more familiar with Brian Forbes than I am. I thought he was good at suspense.
Yeah, he should have been.
I mean, The Taking of Pelham is a pretty suspenseful movie, isn't it?
Yeah. But again, it's a straight terrorist action thriller sort of thing. Mm-hmm. This one, it has to be much more subtle, or you have to have the balls to say, I'm going to piss a bunch of people off with this movie. You know, kind of thing.
I mean, look at what... Okay, sorry to go off on a tangent.
No.
But look at what Roman Polanski did with Rosemary's Baby.
Yep.
Everything in that is normal, and the suspense and creepiness is just tangible in that movie, even though everything is seemingly normal.
Yep.
That's what this movie should have been.
Yes.
And it's by the same writer.
Should have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe actually instead of Brian De Palma, maybe it should have been Polanski. But he was in trouble by then. He was gone.
Well, you know, Rosemary was so much scarier than this. And what made it scary is exactly what you said. It looked normal. And so we start questioning her about, is she losing her marbles, or is this really happening, or whatever. Even that angle would have worked in this movie. That Joanna starts questioning herself about all of this. Mm-hmm. And use more stuff. Like, you know, she's a photographer. We make a big freaking deal about her being a photographer, and yet that doesn't really go anywhere. Or do
actually you? Very similar to The Omen, which came out in 76, a year later, have her see something in one of her photographs.
Yeah.
That is completely out of the ordinary,
yeah,
too.
That would have been a cool little riff. Mm-hmm. You know, she goes to this psychiatrist. One of the cool suspense moments in it is when she actually breaks down with the psychiatrist and, you know, tells her she's afraid. And she's afraid that mm-hmm. they're going to arrange a trip for her and she's going to go away and she's going to come back different.
And the whole time she was with that woman, I was like, that psychiatrist is a Stepford wife. And they don't ever say she is or isn't. And it works. That's what I'm looking for.
Correct. And that was my thing. Yeah. If then in that final scene, he's going, because we can, blah, blah, blah. She sees herself. She turns around and standing right beside him is the psychiatrist. You know, saying, Joanna, this will be better. You'll enjoy this. You know, or something. You know,
exactly.
That would have chilled you and worked. It's just, he just
But they couldn't do it because they would have had to put her in one of those stupid dresses.
He just that was a huge mistake to begin with. If you are going to talk about a masculine version of the perfect wife, she's going to be sexy. She is not wearing a Victorian gown kind of thing or blouse. That's so if you're going to go there, then go there. But I think that was a huge issue. And from what I've read in the backstory, it was all because of Nanette. The fact that she was older than the rest of the cast, she didn't feel like she should expose a lot of skin because I guess she has wrinkly skin. I don't know. But so that's why they made the big wardrobe decision to put them in these frocks kind of thing.
Well, maybe she's old school British. I don't know if she was an English actress.
Could be that, so, that she's like,
she didn't want to wear something scantily.
Wants to be more prim and proper, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it's a shame. Did you have any other scenes?
No. There are no other scenes worth a shit. No, just kidding.
That stood out? I mean, I can't think of any either. I can move on to cast.
Yeah.
But before I do, I'm going to precede this with something that I just found out or that I just remembered writing down. William Goldman and Ira Levin. Oh, that's who wrote it. Ira Levin was originally going to write this as a stage play, until he realized there were too many characters and opted to turn it into a novel instead. Well, that was my problem with it, is that there's so many characters. And this is another reason why I screwed up the Joanna Cassidy stuff earlier, is it's hard for me to keep these characters distinguished. I can't remember who's who and who's married to who.
And, well, they don't give enough of them.
Yeah. And they're all television actors.
Right.
Pretty much. So they all kind of blend in. All right. Let's start off with the best thing about this movie, probably, and that is Catherine Ross. Mm-hmm. I think she's great. I love her. I didn't realize how short she was till I saw when she was standing with other women. I was like, wow, she's a lot shorter than I thought to have been married to Sam Elliott since 1984. They have been married a very long time.
Wow.
We know her. She was an Oscar nominee for The Graduate.
Yep.
That's probably one of her first big roles. Mm-hmm. But she was also in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which was also, like you said, written by William Goldman.
Yep.
Edgar Sherrick, who had secured rights to the novel, was looking to achieve another Rosemary's Baby and wanted to cast Mia Farrow in this role. The idea was quickly dropped, obviously, for obvious reasons.
Yeah, that would have been too much.
Yeah, too much. Mm-hmm. The original, and you may have seen this in that thing I sent you. I sent you a behind-the-scenes interview thing. Mm-hmm. Brian Forbes said that Diane Keaton had the part and then called him and turned it down the night before signing her contract because she had given it to her analyst who got bad vibes.
Yep, yep. Her shrink said, no, don't do this one. This will mess you up.
Yeah, not a good idea. However, a lot of other girls, well, Tuesday Weld was originally also set for the part, but she passed on it. And there were a slew of actresses considered, including Ann Archer, who by 1975, I don't think we'd ever heard of her then. Julie Christie, who we had heard of. Jane Fonda, who I'm sure probably laughed at the script. Jill Clayburgh, Barbara Harris. Speaking of Freaky Friday, we were talking about that earlier.
Yep.
Natalie Wood, Karen Black, who I love and is a great 70s actress, Janet Margolin, Blythe Danner, Genevieve Bujold, Stockard Channing, Jacqueline Bisset, who I also love but was not that strong, Joanna Miles, Elizabeth Montgomery, that would have turned it into a total TV movie, Olivia Hussey, Shirley MacLaine, Joanne Woodward, Glenda Jackson, and of course, I said Diane Keaton. So all of those women were considered. They were the big women of the 70s, I'm thinking, pretty much. Did I say Susan Sarandon? She was in there, too.
Yep.
Okay. So anyway, we got Catherine Ross, and the only thing else I'm going to say about her is that everybody loved her. They said she was wonderful to work with and just a gem on set.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
so no bad stories about the cast there. Bobby Marco was played by Paula Prentice. Joanna Casti, as I said, was originally cast and had actually shot a few scenes, was abruptly fired and replaced. So, and I couldn't find any information as to why. Could you?
No.
But Joanna Casti, for those of you who don't remember her, she's one of the replicants in Blade Runner, and she's just a great character actress that you see in a lot of stuff. She got cut. The husband is played by Peter Masterson,
yeah,
who is not only an actor, but a director, producer, writer. I mean, he's been in a lot of positions in Hollywood because his credits are very sparse as far as acting. But we know him best as the clinic director in The Exorcist. Did you remember that?
Vaguely, yeah. But he looked familiar, and when I looked him up, I saw that and went, oh, okay. Yeah, now I get it.
Yeah. He was also in the Heat of the Night and A Trip to the Bountiful. But he is father of Mary Stuart Masterson, who made her debut in this movie as one of...
his kids.
Joanna's kids,
one
exactly.
Of the Eberhardt's children, mm-hmm. Yes.
Right, Run of the Eberhardt Children. Eberhardt, which sounds like a TV name, too. Well, yes. Christina Eberhardt was married to Dick Eberhardt, who was producer on Saturday Night Live. I mean, don't get in my head, David.
There you go.
It's dangerous. But one thing Peter Masterson is known for the most that I did not realize is that, did you know he adapted The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, the play?
No.
It was based on an article from Playboy by Larry L. King. And he turned it into a musical for Broadway. An article in Playboy. He turned into The Best Little Whorehouse.
Well,
in Texas.
It's good. It's worth it. It's a good movie, too.
Yeah.
I like that movie. Yeah.
Right. I just thought that was interesting about him. I don't have much on Nanette Newman, other than she is Brian Forbes' wife.
Mm-hmm.
She was in International Velvet, which was a sequel to National Velvet, done a decade or so later, yeah. Probably decades later. And so, I mean, that's not much of a resume. So
no, she's done some British stuff. She did a bunch of British stuff.
Okay. But that's a little bit of nepotism at its finest, I would say. Charmaine, as you mentioned, was played by Tina Louise. And I thought she was great. I mean, I had no problems with her at all. And she, of course, is better known as Ginger from Gilligan's Island. But... apparently, she got started on stage. Did you know this? She got discovered as like a stage actress in New York, and
no.
Then she did the movie God's Little Acre, which kind of put her on the map. I'm not familiar with that movie, but then she moved on to mostly TV credits, including that long stint on Gilligan's Island.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah, but I thought she was great. I had no problem with her in this. Dr. Francher, I guess, is the psychiatrist, maybe. She was played by Carol Eve Rawson.
Okay.
The only thing I have is that she was in The Fury, which is a Brian De Palma movie.
Could have been. Yep.
Yeah. William Prince played Ike Mazzard. He's in a lot of soap operas. Carol Mallory was Kit Sunderson. She's television. Frank Cover, who we know as Tom Willis from The Jeffersons.
Yep.
Played Charmaine's husband, Ed. We mentioned Mary Stuart Masterson is the child. Kenneth McMillan played the market manager at the supermarket. That's the dude that flies around in circles in the Dune movie.
He's Baron.
I will never forget that.
He plays Baron Harkonnen. Yeah.
Right, yeah. In that David Lynch movie that's so terrible.
Yeah.
And then if you look really, really closely, very fast, in the scene where Tina Louise as Charmaine is having lunch with Joanna, there is a maid that brings or takes away their yes. plates. That is Dee Wallace. That was her first role. Dee Wallace, a very, very loved genre movie icon of mine. We know her from E.T., The Howling, yeah. Cujo.
And see, that would have been a great, role. And I'm sure, and I swear, I've got to find that screenplay. I'd love to see it. But that would have been a great way to hint at it without, and it being suspenseful without too much in your face, is the fact that Charmaine fires her maid. Because she has a line where she goes, oh, yeah, I fired her. She just wasn't doing a good enough job.
You know?
And it's like, really? She looked like she was doing a great job when we saw her before.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. Yeah. You know, another scene that is a wasted scene in it, I guess. So I complained about the coda at the very end saying it took too long. I would complain about a pivotal scene in it is when he has the meeting of all the men at his house. And Diz actually asks Joanna to join them. But basically, then we get this montage of all this trite conversation they're having and her kind of looking bored through it. Meanwhile, the other dude is drawing her picture. So we're getting all these different agendas in there, but nothing comes from it. She doesn't get to say something like, oh, my God. You know, they have the fight later on where she goes, you actually liked what they were saying because it was all stupid, you know, kind of thing. But there's not enough of that to it. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
That could have been a really great misogynistic sort of pastiche that they do. And then Joanna worries because he doesn't react to it. The fact that they're being so bunch of guys, locker talk or whatever sort of thing. But they don't go that far. They're not willing to go there. So,
no, they're not. And there's plenty of room.
Because
this movie's slow, too.
Yep.
Other than the cast I've mentioned, I wrote, and a lot of other familiar faces, because a lot of them were television actors. One in particular, the guy that plays the guy that stutters. I can't remember his name.
Yeah,
he is in one of my favorite indie dramas, Big Eden, but that's all I remember him from. He's just a familiar face. As far as awards...
Who plays Diz? What's his name? I can't remember his name right now. It's a...
Diz. You're not talking about Ike Mazzard, are you?
No. No, the bad
Diz.
Guy.
Diz.
Think of the bad guy. They call him Diz because he used to work at Disney. Patrick O'Neill.
That's right.
Patrick O'Neill plays.
And another familiar face. He's usually a bad guy, isn't he?
Well, he usually plays the power guy in whatever it is. He did a lot of the smart rich villain kind of role.
He reminds me of somebody that would have been in like a spy show.
Lots of spy shows. He was in think he did
The Avengers or something.
Sort of, but not. It was like he did a lot of Columbos or did a Columbo or two. He did all of the detective ones where he was the bad guy. What was it? I'm trying to remember a big one. Oh, Under Siege. He's the bad guy in Under Siege, Steven Seagal.
Yeah, another familiar face.
Yeah.
But like I said, there's too many people in this movie. I wasn't going to put that entire cast down.
Yeah, ton.
So... As far as awards, the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Movies nominated this for Best Science Fiction Film, and it won. Oh, no, excuse me. It did not win.
Okay.
It did not win. They just nominated. It won for Best Actress, Catherine Ross. I'll give them that. And then it is not on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die, and that's understandable. There are no other awards. The only thing that even sought to nominate it was the Academy of Sci-Fi, Fantasy, and Horror. And that's just because it's a genre film. So,
right.
So it was nominated for one and won one, and it was actress. And that's really the best thing about this movie is Catherine Ross. So that's what I would say. I don't recall anything else, but do you have anything? I may have some trivia before we move on to Keys.
Yeah,
do
go
you?
Ahead.
This is the big trivia I have for it. And you'll know this. Early on during pre-production, Edgar Sherrick suggested that Mary Tyler Moore and Valerie Harper should play Joanna and Bobby, respectively.
Yeah, that they were like the inspirations I'd read, yeah.
They were, but he actually wanted to cast them. It was immediately vetoed by William Goldman, who deemed it gimmicky and a publicity stunt. Funny, we were just talking about William Castle last week.
Yep.
Both actresses were very popular at the time, starring in top-rated sitcoms. But this idea got dismissed before it even began. So that's the trivia I have. Did you have any other?
No. I mean, I've just got a couple of notes that I took during it. The meeting is terrible. The party scene is terrible. Wow, there's a lot of station wagons.
A lot of smoke when they're in that room having that meeting.
She cooks as good as she looks, Ted, is the first hint of trouble. Wouldn't she already know about the mansion if her husband goes there every single night to the men's club? There's only one line where he says, "Why do they call you Diz? Because I used to work at Disneyland." That's the only line, and that's our only inference to animatronics, that he created a robot. But that says a lot about how impactful animatronics and talking presidents and stuff were to the American psyche, that one line can make us assume, oh, they're robots. That was pretty interesting, I thought. So, because one of the things trivia-wise that did come out of this, which is, I guess, a key and a good segue, is the term Stepford Wives became a huge term for that kind of docile housewife respecting the husband kind of thing, especially in the 70s and 80s. So that's probably a huge key out of this that came from it.
Yeah. I keep going back to the scene where all the men are meeting. But one of the best scenes I recall dialogue-wise is the scene where she confronts her husband about that men's club.
Oh,
when
yeah.
She gets in the fight. I was like, wow, because all of a sudden she says, "You've already joined." She insinuates that he's already joined because he only does this. He tells her about it, then he's already done it. Just like he had said, "I would like to move," when he had already bought the house.
Yep.
And I was like, holy shit, man, there is some deep stuff going on between you two, and you probably shouldn't have moved there with him, it sounds like to me.
That is some Goldman dialogue, in my opinion. That one was preserved and works. Yeah, because it seems so realistic. Yeah. And it's that kind of stuff that couples get into about.
Mm-hmm. It's a hardcore fight.
Oh, yeah.
Like verbally.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good one. That's a good point. That's a really good point. Yeah.
And I also was really shocked when she whacked him in the head with that poker from the fireplace. Oh, I was not expecting. I mean, that was as shocking to me as her stabbing that woman. I was like, I don't know if she would do that.
That one I got because she actually says, "Where are my kids?
Where are the kids?
She's leaving and she wants her kids. And he's already chased her around and called the guys and everything else. So she knows that this is bad. So I bought that much more than I did the stabbing Bobby.
Yeah, I guess I could see the angry mother thing.
Yeah. And the determination that she knows he's somehow in on it. He's, again, an emotion that would have been a cool little scene or a side or whatever, is her finally realizing, he's done this to me. He's going to do this to me. But that would have only worked if we had had a much stronger, I think, relationship earlier. But the scene that frustrated me, especially in the modern context, is she is looking out for, is it Joanna's kids? It's either Joanna's kids or Charmaine's kids. And she's watching them for the weekend while they go away for their romantic weekend.
It's Bobby's kids.
It's Bobby's kids. And
yeah.
It's the breakfast scene.
That's her friend.
And they're all screaming, and she's trying to do everything, and he's bitching and moaning about them screaming and yelling.
That was the worst scene.
And keeps saying, "Can you get me a cup of coffee, please? Hey, give me a cup of coffee." He doesn't say please. Sorry. But, you know, and it's this that could have been so much better and more frustrating, especially in the modern, as we in modern times look back at it.
And it looked fake. I mean, it was fake.
Yeah.
No one would talk like that.
It looked cliche and out of the... it just looked bad. Yeah.
Why does he get more pancakes? I need some more coffee.
Right.
And he kept repeating the same line. And I'm like, dude, you can tell she's busy. This is insane. Yeah, this is... It looked like a commercial. It literally looked like a commercial.
Good.
Something
good point.
Overdone and cliche. Yeah.
Yep. Keys.
Well, you've already mentioned the sequel, obviously, The Sefford Wives.
Correct.
That came out in 2004. Not the sequel, but the remake, I guess you would say, of it. But the biggest key to me that I got out of this, even though it's not done nearly as well, is Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
That's a great one. It's a good one.
Yeah, where you think you know somebody and they're not who they are at all. They are either an alien or a robot or what have you.
Well, and the whole thing of they are slowly taking over people.
Yes.
And people that at points where your friends you trusted, now you can't because they aren't. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a good pass key that that influenced this, I think. One that this definitely influenced is Get Out.
Right.
And Get Out is a much better example of this entire feel, except it's racial, not gender.
Female.
Politics.
It's not feminist, it's racial. Yeah.
It's not gender, it's racial, but it is so much better paced, it's scarier, better performed, acted, story, everything. And Jordan Peele has said this was a direct influence on Get Out. That Stepford Wives was a direct influence on the movie.
Well, he has, and I'm pretty sure when we covered it, we said Stepford Wives as a key to it.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure we did too.
Yeah. Another one, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, there are several movies of that type, and I couldn't think of their names, so I just used Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Very similarly, there are several movies, and you may be able to come up with some, of this type, but the only one I could come up with is Harvest Home. When they go to a town and something is not right with the town and you start slowly realizing what's going on and these people aren't what they think what you think they are. And Harvest Home is the first one that comes to my mind. That is Thomas Tryon. It's an old – or Tryon. Thomas Tryon. Yeah. It's an old example, and I'm sure there's a more modern example of something similar. I just cannot think of it.
Well, you got the lottery. You've got, what did we cover? A Mouth of Madness, where the town doesn't feel right. Yeah. Something's weird, you know. So, I think there's a lot of that genre of move into a town that seems something's odd or off.
And I'm a fan of that fear. That trope intrigues me, and I really, really like it. And I think that's why I ended up liking this movie a little better. Because I had lower expectations. Trope itself.
I think if it hadn't been treated like a TV movie, it would have been a lot better. You know, that trope itself, that's a huge Stephen King trope.
It's a great trope, and that's why
whether it's Salem's Lot or
Needful Things. Yeah, because Ben Mears comes to town. And
Needful Things, all of that about the town is slowly changing around you kind of feel. And how isolating that can be to the lead characters. That could be really cool. But they just didn't touch on it here.
I honestly think that's all I have.
Well, I've got another trope that comes out of it, which is the whole Westworld thing. Westworld came out in a similar time frame, but especially the modern reboot of Westworld series is about losing your identity for the greater good kind of thing. And what is really your identity? And you're a sentient robot. So that's, I think, a big key.
If you go that far, you could almost say The Matrix.
To an extent, finding out
to
your
an
world.
Extent,
but that's more of a finding out your world isn't what your world is. Your reality is different. You can't believe your reality.
Right, your entire reality is different.
I've got two last things. One was I read something online that said that this is actually a variation of Alice in Wonderland. And Carol Van Zandt is the White Rabbit because she's the first one that alerts Joanna. And it's all about, Joanna is Alice all the way through it, slowly figuring everything out. The Red Queen is Diz. And I was going, okay, I think you're kind of pushing the literary mark there, but I could see a little bit of that, maybe. But I thought it was interesting that someone had written that as that's what their keys were.
That sounds like a senior term paper.
Yeah, there you go. I've got, obviously, based on what they did, they tried to make it the 1950s housewife icon. That was a key in what the men were trying to create in their Stepford women. was this subservient. Who's the father knows best, or who's the mom in the 50s?
Jane Wyman.
Or whoever that 50s Leave It to Beaver sort of that mom character.
Donna Reed.
Yeah, Donna Reed. That's it, Donna Reed.
Donna Reed's like the prototype that people use as like a cliche. Yeah.
Always has the coffee warm in there, and you know, I'll be cooking
and
for everybody
like
all
a
the
cute
time.
Skirt with my a little apron.
Yeah. Hair and makeup is always beautiful. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But again, had they gone with those T-link skirts and those little aprons, that would have been even better. Rather than the
and you know, something else that kind of bothers me about this is that if it's supposed to be, they kept trying to defend it as a feminist movie.
Right.
And it's not.
No.
Really at all. But what really kind of bothers me is they play up the sympathy for the men. They constantly are showing Joanna's husband as if he's struggling with making a decision.
Yes.
And they constantly show Charmaine's husband struggling. And they show him literally breaking down in the car after it has happened.
Yeah.
And I'm like, they're trying to make us sympathize with these men.
Yeah.
And that's not what this movie is about at all.
I'm so glad you said that, because that gets to my last point, which is preface my last point by saying Forbes has commented that he got bad press after the release from both sides. From the feminist side saying this isn't a feminist movie, and from the male side saying you're trying to do a feminist movie. He said he got complaints about it. But anyway, that sets up perfect because I found a quote in his own book, Adventures in the Screen Trade. William Goldman attempted to explain the reasoning behind his vision of what the epitomous wives should look like. So this goes to what we've been talking about the entire time of his concept and everything else. You'll love this as a writer. Quote, look, this is a movie about insane men. Insane and so frightened of women, so panicked that their wives might even begin to assert themselves that they resort to murder and replacement of them. And if you are so insanely desperate, so obsessed with women being nothing but subordinate sex objects, if you are willing to spend the rest of your days humping a piece of plastic, well, shit, that plastic better goddamn well be in the form of Bo Derek. You don't commit murder and make a new creation to have it look like Nanette Newman.
Ooh, that was a little jab at the end.
Yeah. But it kind of says what Goldman was trying to do with that original screenplay. And obviously they, you know, changed all that to not do it. But I thought that was very interesting, the fact that just what you said, they portray the men as sensitive in this, and you can't. They're the villains. Do. They're the bad guys.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like, and the whole time you see, what is his name? The Masterson's character, Walter.
Walter.
The whole time you see Walter after they've moved to Stepford, he's pretty much contemplating and like irritable.
Yeah.
Because it's clear he's trying to make a decision that he's somewhat being led into.
Yeah, they are forcing him to this.
Yeah, but then there's that scene with Ed Wimperis in the car after, clearly it's after he's had Charmaine removed to be made into a robot or whatever. And he's crying. I mean, he is clearly upset. And I was like, wow, this is mixed messages. Mixed messages.
Very much. All the way through it, I think. I agree with you.
Yeah. So I guess that's a good way to sum it up.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to like this movie. It's an iconic movie. Mm-hmm. I don't think it belongs on the 1001 movies you must see before you die list.
Nope.
But there's a reason why this movie is very memorable, I guess, in history. It was a time when feminism was, you know, very in vogue. I mean, it was happening in the 70s, and this movie did nothing to further help it at all, really.
Yes,
it was a noble effort.
One way or the other, you know?
No, not at all.
We classified it as science fiction because I don't think you could call this movie a horror movie.
Even though it is October.
Not even in the context of 1975. I mean, 75 was Jaws. So, yeah, there were...
Oh, my God. I actually had... I wrote that at the very beginning of this, and I forgot to say that. In this year, we not only got Jaws, we also had One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Nashville. I mean, those are huge movies that came out in 1975.
Well, and if you wanted,
came out too.
If you wanted terror on television, even, which this is a television movie, it's written, directed. I mean, it's directed and lit like a television movie. Trilogy of Terror came out in 1975. It's twice as scary as this movie,
and it has Karen Black in it.
It's Karen Black, yeah. But anyway,
but what I was going to say is, I don't know that I could recommend this movie unless you are enthusiasts like we are.
Yeah.
And then, yes, you should watch this movie.
Of course.
But if you're looking for a good scary movie, no.
If you're a cinephile, watch this movie. Yes, I agree.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And we would like to know what you guys out there think. Be sure and let us know in the comments below. And while you're down there, subscribe if you're watching us on YouTube. If not, and you're listening to us on the airwaves, please either thumbs up us, like us, rate us, rank us, or leave a review with your favorite podcast platform of choice. Mm-hmm. If you're watching us on YouTube, we have other shows out there about coming attractions, coming to get you, and some streaming options of horror with me. And sometimes we do a top five about a year. We didn't do 75, but we did do 76 here recently. Yep. And you can see that one out there. And if that's not enough for you, we could always use your support. So if you like what you hear, please go to Patreon and, you know, pledge as much as a cup of coffee a month. And you can get some supplemental material as well. We do two subscription-based programs. One is on the original Star Trek show. We've got two seasons of that. One is on X-Files. We've got two seasons of that, as well as other things on there that are not subscription-based, including bonus episodes. Mm-hmm. And it is the month of October. We try and do scary movies. I was struggling this year to pick some scary sci-fi, and this was one of them. But next week will be much scarier. I can promise you that. And until then, I will be seeing you soon, David.
All right. See you then.
All righty. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.